Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we have a huge amount of questions from listeners. I'm going to cover as many of them as I can. It makes sense that you have tons of questions right now because student loans are a mess. They've been a mess as long as I've been doing this, but they're extra messy right now and it's extra ridiculous. So I am going to share with you a lot of these questions. This is probably coming out on April Fool's Day, so I'm actually going to be giving real answers, but hopefully you can get some serious answers on a day where you might get fooled. So if you listen to this in the morning, you've already been warned. So let's listen to some of these listener questions.
Hi, Travis. There's been some conflicting information from things I've seen online and in talking to some people. The question has to do with going for public service loan forgiveness if you are on an IBR plan, and then eventually if your income increases and you no longer qualify as a financial hardship and then are switched to a standard payment. For me specifically, I had some loans that were older, and so I had to do direct consolidation to qualify them. And what I've heard is that if you have a direct consolidation, that standard repayment plan, the monthly payments would not be qualifying payments for, like PSLF. But looking at the actual statute for the public service loan forgiveness plan, it looks like that if you have a 10-year term, then even under the consolidated plan, that it would be a qualifying payment. I know that the standard plan term can vary from 10 to 30 years, but it looks like it, at least for me, and I think for most people, when their income goes up, the IBR has a cap that's at that 10-year standard repayment plan. So to me, it seems like that would qualify even if you are out of it, an IBR or IDR plan. I was just hoping that, if you had some experience with this and might be able to add some clarity to that. Thank you.
The answer to this question is absolutely wild. And I learn something every month doing this for like 9 years. And I'm shocked that I'm still learning things that just, that's how complicated the loan system is. So the standard 10-year plan does count for PSLF. The standard repayment plan for consolidated loans does not. So when you consolidate a loan more than $60,000, it turns into the standard 30-year plan, but it's just called standard repayment. And standard repayment for a 60K plus sized loan ends up working out to a 30-year amortized loan schedule. If you think about that amount, it's not something that would qualify for PSLF. But the standard 10-year plan does count if you've not consolidated your loans. But there's a very important caveat, and this caveat has not existed in 5 years. And the caveat is, if you look at the standard 10-year plan, what they're supposed to do according to the statute is amortize that standard 10-year plan according to how much time you've already been in repayment towards a 10-year total time in repayment that you need to be in to pay off your loans. Well, what happened during COVID? The Trump administration and the Biden administration counted the COVID forbearance as time in repayment. So what happened is when everybody got out of the COVID forbearance, pretty much most people going for PSLF have at least 2, 3, 4, 5 years of repayment towards their loans when they weren't really making payments at all in a lot of cases, right? People's payments were zero, but they were enrolled in an income-driven repayment plan. And so since that's like 5 years towards repayment, or in some cases, if you had some payments from before COVID, 7 or 8 years or even 9 years towards repayment, your final standard 10-year payments are so large that it almost looks like a mistake when they send you the billing notice in the mail. So that huge, absolutely enormous payment that people are getting right now, in a lot of cases, because their recertifications are coming up and they're told, hey, you better recertify or else you're gonna have to pay the standard 10-year plan. And the standard 10-year plan is somehow $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month, and you're like, what the heck? The reason is because the statute was written that way or the rules were written that way. And the servicers are actually applying it this time. Honest to goodness, I don't remember the servicers even applying the rule back when I was advising people on repayment from before COVID. So it's like pretty wild to me that if you look at the actual rule, it says you're amortizing the standard 10-year plan, based, and you're including in that standard 10-year amortization like time you've already been in repayment, and you have to amortize it over a shorter period if you've been in repayment for, more than, if you've been in repayment really any time at all. This is the trap. This is why I'm so concerned for borrowers that are going to not have a partial financial hardship to get loan forgiveness, depending on how these court cases go. It's because people have to have a hardship, have a personal financial hardship, which is not what it sounds like, right? It's a technical definition where your IDR payment has to be lower than your standard 10-year plan, right? So, what a weird situation. What a weird set of loan rules to have, but that's the rule. And so people really are going to be in big trouble if ICR gets repealed, because that is the safety valve right now. If somebody does not have a partial financial hardship, they can get into the ICR plan and have a maximum payment that works out to roughly a standard like 6-year amortization, give or take. So really heavy technical answer to start this one, guys, but let's keep going.
Hi, Travis. My name is Andrew. I'm a longtime listener. Appreciate the work that you all do over at SLP. My question regards my student loan situation going for aggressive payoff. I haven't heard this method mentioned as much recently in any of the podcasts. I am currently at a federally qualified health center. I have about $140,000 in federal student loans, non-consolidated, and then my income currently is about $120,000 a year. My oldest loan was taken out after 2014. So just looking at the variety of plans, I'm looking at switching over from the save, which I'm on forbearance, to either the standard plan or consolidating and perhaps refinancing. The reason is because at this location, I qualify for a state loan repayment or NHSC, where I would get about $30,000 a year for 3 years of work, total of $90,000 over the course of 3 years. I do think it's reasonable for me to be able to pay off my loans in hopefully 3 to 5 years by putting money towards them in addition to that tax-free benefit that I would get from working at this location. I do see myself staying here for a long time, but from the psychological aspect, I would prefer to try to pay them down sooner rather than waiting 10 or 20 years for forgiveness. So that's my current situation. I'm welcoming to any thoughts. But yeah, again, I don't think that switching to an income-based repayment plan, IBR, or any of the income plans would be in my best benefit if I'm going for aggressive payoff. Please let me know if there's any other thoughts. But yeah, currently thinking between the standard 10-year plan or the refinancing route. But because I'd be able to get $30,000 a year for 3 years of work and then possibly able to extend that further later, I think that is reasonable to be able to make the otherwise rather large payments. So please let me know your thoughts. Thank you.
So one of the big issues with these FQHC kind of places and like public health places that often offer loan repayment is like, you know, let's be honest, they're offering loan repayment benefits for a reason. It's because it's difficult to recruit somebody there and keep them there long term. That's just an honest to goodness truth. It's obviously like wonderful that people want to go to these FQHCs and these types of employers, but remember that your number one and first obligation is to your own mental health, your own family's financial and physical health, and your own happiness. Because if you burn out, you're not good for anybody. So it's like you're putting your own oxygen mask on first. And so what I have seen with, you know, I've done this a long time. I've done thousands of individual consults, probably at least several dozen from different people at different types of public health, you know, FQHC type employers. And what I see happen a lot is people burn out or they get tired or they get exhausted. Now, that's not everybody. I want to be clear about that, but it is a majority of people. And so when you think about, you know, the majority of people that are ready to switch out of that type of employer after 2 or 3 years in, that would suggest that you want to keep your options open. And how do you keep your options open? Do a little bit of both. If you have an IDR repayment plan, you're getting credit towards forgiveness, right? There's no harm in doing that. There's no harm. The only harm is like the difference in the interest rate on your federal versus a refinanced loan. So that's like maybe a 6% benefit for compared to a 5%. And when you think about that $30K repayment benefit, you know, you can use that as a lump sum to cover all your IDR obligation or hopefully even reimburse yourself for direct IDR payments you make yourself, which is preferable. And so what you do is you reimburse yourself for the IDR payments and, you know, any excess you just put towards the loans and you pay the minimum and you do that for however long you want to stay there. And one of two things will happen, right? Either you will hit a point where, you know, you have capped payments on like IBR or something and you're just paying those capped payments and then you're done with PSLF, or you pay the loan off. It's okay to take your time paying your loans off. I'm not saying that because I want you to listen to this podcast for many more years. Don't get me wrong. Like, true crime's better. I'm under no illusions that, you know, people listen to my podcast for the entertainment value, right? It's to save money. And so my suggestion would be keep your options open. Don't super focus on the loans when you've got a lot of other things going on in your life that you could enjoy. And then have that benefit reimburse your loan repayment. And then have the rest of the benefit just be put on your loans. And then reevaluate in a couple years because you may or may not want to continue working at that kind of employer. I mean, I remember one example that always jumps out of my head at me, really burned in my head, is this two dentist couple. They were driving 1.5 hours in the opposite direction, each of them every day, living in a small rural town. So one of them could go work in this faraway practice that offered loan repayment, and another one could go work in a faraway practice like 1.5 hours north that offered loan repayment. They're driving this through the snow, through the sleet. You know, sometimes their commute would turn into 2 hours each way. They were doing this all for this loan repayment benefit. And I was like, hey guys, you have $400K in loans from dental school. Did you know that you're going for forgiveness, like no matter what, like via IDR? And this only benefit you're getting is just like the reimbursement of your IDR payment, which is already really low because your tax return for the prior year is really low. So you're really not even getting that much benefit from driving 2 hours one way. And you could have heard a pin drop because people were like, they were floored and they were like, so sort of feeling heaviness from like having made this massive life sacrifice that they made literally just because of their loans. And, you know, they realized that they had a lot more options. And so, I apologize if y'all are listening to this. Hopefully not. Hopefully you're done with your loans and you're feeling happy and stress-free now. You know, I didn't share obviously anybody's names or anything or locations, so you wouldn't know who it is. But you get the idea that you never, ever, ever want a loan program determining what you should be doing with your life and career. It's always a bad decision. So let's do some more questions.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for all the great advice on the podcast. I'm on the Save Forbearance with 7 years of credit toward PSLF. I applied on studentaid.gov to switch onto the IBR plan in early November, but my application still says pending. I'm wondering if people are actually succeeding in making that change and how. I've made so many phone calls to Mohila, and even before Trump took office, they have said they cannot process applications to change onto IBR from SAVE until the Department of Ed gives them the go-ahead. One person at Mohila recently told me they could put me on processing forbearance so that my months count toward PSLF while I wait. But when I called to follow up this month, they said that was not actually true, and that the only way to get PSLF credit right now is to switch to a standard repayment plan. I'm curious if people are actually succeeding in getting onto IBR from SAVE or getting processing forbearance instead of SAVE forbearance. Thanks so much for any clarification you can provide.
People are not getting processed any faster with any particular tricks right now, at least that I'm seeing. So, you know, there are some people out there that, you know, applied for IBR pre-Trump presidency. I think we have seen some evidence that some people have gotten switched over, but it's not something that the loan borrowers have been able to control. It's just sort of like the servicers are just going to do what they do right now. If you want to do your best to get it processed, you can submit a wet signed IBR application that you can get from searching IDR application Reddit link. And then you can find the latest version of the IDR application, which has got a 2027 expiration date on it. And then you can submit that along with prior year 1040. You want to print out the IBR application, sign it, and then re-upload that and your 1040 into a scanned document, and then upload it directly to your servicer portal. That's the best way to apply for IBR right now, but it still doesn't process anything for you. It just makes you feel like you did something, to be honest, is what we're able to tell so far. And so I would probably, if you're kind of a person that is okay waiting, then I would just wait. And you're probably going to end up in the same place, to be honest, unfortunately. So that's probably the best advice I can give right now. Is it's not fun, but there's no way around the waiting game. Now let's take another one.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for staying so vigilant about student loans and keeping us updated on all the exciting twists and turns as they develop in the seemingly never-ending saga in the student loan world. I have two questions. My first one has to do with the fact that I'm a current grad student taking out grad plus loans to fund my education, and I'm expecting an adjustment and then a disbursement from that adjustment of my current Grad Plus loan, supposed to be by the end of March. And I'm now becoming increasingly concerned that I may not get that. in sort of due time by the end of March. I'm sort of counting on those funds and a little increasingly concerned I'm not going to get the money because of potential delays. So I'm just curious your thoughts on if you think student loan processing, i.e. new loans or loans for people currently in school, may be delayed due to any of these factors, i.e. the stop work order, the Department of Ed closure, or at least potentially shunting all the student loans to the Department of Treasury, and or even the potential government shutdown that may happen this Friday if they don't pass the budget bill. My second question has to do with my past student loans that I consolidated by the IDR waiver deadline last year, and then I applied and I think I got accepted onto the SAVE program. But then as we know, the SAVE program is probably toast if it isn't already. So I'm just curious, what would be your recommendation for someone like me who has a significant past student loan balance that is currently, I can't remember if it's in school forbearance or in school deferment, but it's one of those where I'm currently not paying because I'm in school. What you would recommend for someone like me who's qualified for that on the SAVE program, but knowing that the SAVE probably won't survive, should I just go ahead and apply for IBR? I qualify for old school IBR since I took out my first loan prior to 2014. So those are my questions. Thanks so much.
For your loans that you have for your program you're already in, you can continue to borrow. I'm not expecting anything to go wrong with that. I think that there will be a bill at some point to try to change the terms of the Grad Plus program, but every draft of any potential legislation I've ever seen from Republicans always talks about changing it only for students signing up for a program as of a certain date as new borrowers. So that's what you should expect on the new borrowing part of things and the old borrowing part of things. You can't get into IBR probably right now at all on loans even that you already have if you're in an in-school deferment. Theoretically, PLUS loans should be able to have an in-school deferment waiver request submitted. And for Grad PLUS loans in particular, you theoretically should be able to get off of that in school deferment and get on IBR, but that's theoretical. That's the key operative word there. The reality is nothing's happening right now. You have a lot of people that are completely being laid off, and half of people at Department of Ed don't have a job, and they're talking about moving all loan management to the Small Business Administration, which is not legal. Obviously, it's just going to be a gigantic mess because they don't have the staff at all with the appropriate knowledge to be able to help borrowers. And so borrowers are just going to have to be their own best advocates. So let's take another question.
Hey, Travis. Just want to say thanks for all the great information you put out in the world. It's so helpful, and it's something for which I'm enormously grateful. Thanks so much. I'm just listening to your most recent podcast. It's Tuesday, March 11th. It's about the dumpster fire that is the Department of Education right now. And you said something that I thought was very interesting that I'd like some additional clarification on. It was about the 2027 IDR application that you said we could potentially find, I believe you said, on Reddit via the Wayback Machine if we felt impatient about getting an IDR application in process. So the question, or rather the clarification that I'm looking for, is around IBR or IDR applications that are currently in process. So for instance, in my case, I submitted an application about 3.5 months ago, specifically a switch from the SAVE to the IBR income-based repayment plan. And it had been in processing limbo. And then, of course, now the most recent court injunction has paused it entirely. Do you think, for those of us who already had applications in process, that we should attempt that approach that you described in the podcast to download that application and submit it? Or do you think we should simply wait? And I ask because if they are changing the IDR application to conform to the most recent court injunction, does that mean potentially that any applications in process now, such as mine, would be invalidated and therefore we'd have to start over again? I guess what I'm really getting at here is I don't want to have to start at the back of the line all over again. I mean, I was getting probably pretty close to having mine processed when it got paused, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are in the same boat. So I'm curious to know what you think we should do given this situation. Again, thanks so much for everything, Travis.
I think I would just wait. Honestly, I don't think that there's any guarantee that reapplying would get you to the front of the line at all. It might just confuse them. So I would probably just wait and just hope for the best. And, you know, if it does invalidate it, what are the scenarios where they invalidate your application, but the 2027 application that they had a problem with, that they pulled down, that they 404 errored on the site, that they don't also pull that one and validate that one? Does that make sense? So that's kind of why, if you've already got an IBR application in submitted a long time ago, that's a great point that this listener made. I would not resubmit because of the logic of, well, if they have a problem with the one you've already submitted, then of course they're going to have a problem with the one that they pulled down from the website and made a 404 error for. So that's why I would just be patient. If you've already submitted that IBR application, I think that it is true that you could submit another one. Like, that's not illegal. It's not probably going to harm you, but I don't think it helps you. And I think that, you know, when I have had time where I guess to think through this logic a little bit more, I think it's probably just not necessary. And it, you know, I guess there's a chance it could hurt you in the sense that somehow they look at this most recent application and they like stop working on your old one, right? I don't think that's a huge risk, but I guess it is a risk. So I probably would lean towards doing nothing if you've already applied. Now let's take another question.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for all the advice you offer us. So I got approved for IBR on March 8th, and my loans were borrowed from 2016 to 2020. My understanding is that qualifies me as a new borrower under the IBR plan, and that my payment should be capped at 10% of my discretionary income. My loan servicer is Ed Financial, and they are insisting that there's no such thing as new IBR or old IBR borrowers, and all IBR payment plans are capped at 15% regardless of when you borrowed your loans. I don't think that's right, and I don't know how to fight this. I did send a complaint to the FSA website, but I don't know, you know, if that does anything. And Ed Financial keeps saying that they're not going to change my payment because my IBR was calculated correctly, even though it should have been capped at 10% of my discretionary income, and instead they're capping it at 15%. Do you have any advice for when the loan servicer is doing something like this that is not right, but also they're not willing to admit that they're wrong? I just feel a little stuck here. Thank you.
This definitely sounds like one of those, you call the loan rep and the loan rep is new and has been there for 3 weeks. And they're like, oh, I know better than you. I work here. And, you know, it's always 15% because I've made it up. And I've had so many of these emails from people where like, they're like, I called Mohila. I called Ed Financial. You have to think about, who are you calling? You are calling, and I don't want to be mean here, but you are calling somebody on average who probably has 3 to 6 weeks of training, maybe 3 to 6 months, if we're maybe a little bit more charitable, who makes $15 to $20 an hour, who is trying to answer questions for people, trying to do a good job with an extraordinarily complicated and messed up system. So they are doing their best, but that is the kind of response that you're getting, is a customer service center response from a government contractor that was chosen because they charged the government the least amount of money. And obviously that means they're also going to be reinvesting the very least as possible in their workforce, because that's how the contractor was chosen in the first place, was because they were going to charge the government a low amount of money. It's very common that you call your servicer person and they give a totally wrong answer. What I would say is, first, be sure about it. Be sure that you're a new IBR borrower instead of an old IBR borrower. Know that the naming convention of new IBR doesn't exist. It is only IBR. And the only difference is if you qualify for the new version of it or the old version of it, but all the people will call it IBR. And then I would just look at the math. We have a calculator on our website that you can find if you type in IBR calculator, that will show you what your payment should be on the new IBR plan versus the old IBR plan. It will be really clear as to what your payment should be based off of whatever most recent taxable income that you used. So that's the other part of it, is you want to use in the calculator whatever most recent taxable income you used. And for a lot of people, that number's all over the place. Some people haven't recertified since before COVID. Some people have recertified more recently. And so you want to make sure you're using the right number to calculate your IBR payment. But yeah, I'm expecting there to be a lot of problems like this. And so we're going to have people probably reach out to their congresspersons or senators via constituent services once we're perfectly sure that there's been a mistake that's made, to make sure that people pay the correct amount, not the incorrect amount. Let's listen to another question.
Hey there, y'all. I am just curious about whether or not you've heard anything regarding the PSLF verbiage that needs to be included. This is something I'm seeing in the Reddit threads where folks are getting denied. When they ask why they're getting denied, it's because they didn't include the correct verbiage, even though they included it directly from the website as instructed. I've even seen threads where when they follow up with FSA, they're told that the verbiage has changed and they're updating it, but the update hasn't been posted to the website. So it sounds like people who are using that verbiage from the current website are just getting denied because there's an update that hasn't been posted yet. But you all have your finger on the pulse a lot better than I do. So I was curious if you've heard anything regarding that verbiage. Thanks.
So this kind of stuff is honestly constantly changing. And instead of worrying about submitting the verbiage right the very first time, what I would do is just submit what is on the FSA website. And when and if you get denied, they are supposed to tell you why, and then you will know that there's a problem, and then you will be able to get the updated verbiage. And, you know, we just have the benefit of a lot larger sample size than most people. Most people are dealing with sample size of one, and they haven't applied yet. We deal with a sample size of hundreds of people, like every month. And so we tend to see more rapidly, like statistically significant things that happen, and we adjust our advice accordingly. We use a thing called Text Expander. It's kind of helpful. I think a lot of people should use it if you do a lot of customer replies kind of thing. And so we have like a team kind of response for like PSLF buyback when somebody's doing that. Because what this person's referencing is only happening when somebody does a PSLF buyback application, which to be frank, probably all PSLF borrowers are going to need to be doing because everybody pretty much has, or most people pretty much have at least 6 or 7 or 8 months of a forbearance period because of PSLF buyback, right? So that's kind of an interesting thought that basically every PSLF borrower is going to be needing to submit a buyback request, or they're just going to pay too much money towards their loans, unless the program, of course, gets repealed, which frankly, I think it will be at some point here in the next year or two. But go ahead and submit for it, do your best, and when and if you get denied, you know, you can apply again for it. Now, you might say, well, what if it gets repealed in between, you know, when I applied and when I submitted the right verbiage? I don't think that's something to worry about. Like, I think they're probably processing these at such a glacial speed right now that I really don't think that's going to make the difference between people getting PSLF buyback and people not getting it. I will say that we run like a PSLF physicians Facebook group. There's a lot of commentary in that group about what verbiage is being used and has been used. And so I would just kind of point people to resources like that or Reddit or something for the free version of, you know, what do I need to post for PSLF buyback? Obviously, for people doing a consult, you know, we go to extra lengths to make sure that we're giving people the right language based on the time that they do the consult. So pretty interesting question. Let's take another one.
Hi, Travis. I'm currently in school, wrapping the first year of my Master of Social Work program at a prestigious and expensive university. I chose to come here hoping to have my significant debt forgiven through an income-driven repayment plan or public service loan forgiveness. Without these plans, this program would make little financial sense for me given my aspirations to start my own nonprofit and achieve financial independence early in life. Should I gamble my aspirations on this program, which I love, or hedge my bet on public service loan forgiveness, transfer to a cheaper part-time program, and begin working? Thanks.
I love these questions. They're so well thought out. We have really smart listeners. I would stick with the program you're already on. You've already made a bet, so you probably already have a significant amount of debt that would still be kind of difficult to repay if you didn't have any access to loan forgiveness. And even if you transferred, you know, you would still have that big debt, and so your plan probably is not going to change all that much. You know, ultimately, if they do follow through with their threats of, you know, repealing all these loan forgiveness programs and such, I really don't think that you can expect that's going to happen for people who already have loans that are already enrolled in school already. Another thing to think about, and this is hopefully a comforting thought, right, to people that are really hoping for loan forgiveness but are just really scared right now. Eventually, the Republicans will not hold all three branches of power, executive, legislative, and the courts, right, judicial. Eventually, what's going to happen is you're going to have a Democratic president and a Democratic House and Senate one day. That is not me saying like this should be the outcome, that should be the outcome. What I'm saying is just a statement of reality. Eventually, Republicans will lose control and Democrats will take over, and then eventually Republicans will take control again. That's just how democracy works, right? Like if there's a bad recession, sometimes it's the fault of the party in power. Sometimes it's not, but everybody blames them anyway. And the bastards get kicked out, right? That's the old joke, right? Like kick the bastards out. Poor politicians, they're always losing power. So the party in power gets kicked out of power. So what would I be thinking about if I was a master's in social work student right now, knowing that PSLF is something that's, you know, really critical for me? What I would know is 20 or 25 years of IDR forgiveness is a long time. Even 10 years is a long time. If this person's already in school, by the time they graduate, you only have two more years or so of the Trump administration, and they have another election. What is the chance that the party out of power will win that election? Probably greater than 50%, maybe 55 or 60%, right? What is the probability that even if the Republicans win, that they lose the House or the Senate? Probably more likely to lose the House. And those chances are probably greater than 50% if you think about the incumbency penalty. Once you have a split control of power, there's a lot of concessions that can happen and will happen, especially if they were too restrictive on reining in loan forgiveness, right? Because let's be real, the Democratic Party has this huge constituency of very educated voters now. And that's why you saw student loans become such a huge focal point for the Democrats in this recent election, is because they know that they have this huge split for more working class voters that are favoring Republicans and more educated voters that are more favoring Democrats. And so student loan forgiveness is essentially like a core base issue now for the Democratic Party. I would anticipate that even if the catastrophic scenario happened that a lot of people are worried about with loans, I think all you have to do is literally wait for Democratic control of one or more branches of government, and a lot of the things people would be worried about would be restored and possibly retroactively credited. I mean, think about all the stuff that happened with the Biden administration. Has the PSLF waiver been legally challenged? No. Has the IDR account adjustment been legally challenged? No. You know, has the SAVE plan been legally challenged? Yes. Why? Because they were bragging about it. I mean, to be honest, right? They were bragging about it, bragging about how everybody has a low zero payment. The majority of people have a zero payment, bragging about how many people they were going to get loan forgiveness. Obviously, conservative Republicans didn't like that. Then the Biden administration tried to essentially very quickly go around the court saying, hey, we have some concerns about this plan. And the Biden administration's literal response was like, oh, we can just take the SAVE plan terms and then we can just call it repay because that used to be a plan. So we're just going to take the SAVE plan and just call it repay and we're just going to ignore all the court's orders. And the court was like, screw you guys, we're going to put an injunction on absolutely everything. How do you like that? And so this is the mess that's going on, right? Maybe that's obviously a lot more than this bar needed, but like, I think that you're safe. I think you don't have to worry. I think everything's going to be fine. I think you should stay where you're at. I think you're going to get PSLF just fine with IBR. And I think that, you know, with the new IBR version, if you're a new borrower as of 2014, by the way, and then I think that if you have a catastrophic event happen, you essentially need to put your loans into some sort of hibernation pattern with either forbearances or, you know, an extended graduated plan where you're paying, you know, a fraction of your balance every month. And you're putting them in that holding pattern until you get a more favorable political environment for loan forgiveness. And if that doesn't work, take the move abroad effect and go take the foreign earned income exclusion where you don't have to pay tax in your first $120K of earnings earned abroad as a U.S. citizen. File your U.S. tax return where you claim $0 of taxable income because of that exclusion, and then submit your loan repayment IDR application where you have no income and you pay nothing. And then you can just live abroad. So there's all kinds of choices that you have. People just have to know all the loopholes. So let's listen to a few more questions.
Hi, Travis. Thanks for all the information you've been providing in the podcast and in emails. My name's Zach, and I'm a first-year resident. I wanted to highlight that after talking with the Better Business Bureau, filing a complaint, as well as reaching out to constituent services at the local House member's office, I have now had my federal student loans properly consolidated and applied in the SAVE forbearance. This has been an ongoing problem since May of 2024, and relieved to finally have that completed. Thanks for the advice. My question today is regarding tax filing for 2024. I'd like to file an extension to figure out what the next steps are going to be from the Trump administration. What do I need to know regarding filing a tax extension, given that I'm probably going to owe approximately $3,000 in taxes for the 2024 year?
The first big tip is you got to make that estimated payment by the deadline for normal tax time. So make that estimated payment and maybe even throw in a little bit extra, maybe goose it a little bit with 10% on top of what you think you might owe. You can always apply it to estimated payments next year. And the reason for that is you have to pay all that you owe by that deadline. Now, if you file an extension and you're short on what you owe, then you're not talking about huge penalties or anything like that. If you file no extension and you owe, then you have to pay like penalties and interest. And the penalties and interest aren't like horrific, but they're just not fun. So in general, if you file an extension, even if you screw up a ton of stuff, you're still going to be okay, generally speaking. And then if you file an extension and you make your estimated tax payments that you're thinking that you might owe, then you're really okay. And then the only question is like, when do you file your final return? I want to say that, you know, this has been very difficult because we have a tax business and we had logic in place, and I'm still confident in the logic that we had. But then, of course, with this last second IDR recertification announcement, it does kind of make extensions better than they were before. I think it's still fine if people filed already. I think I still stand behind all of our logic with our tax team, but this is kind of why student loan aware tax planning and prep, I think, helps a lot of people, because the problem is like all the logic can kind of change mid-tax season with this, which is just ridiculous. You know, if I was doing it myself and I was trying to figure out what do I do with my taxes right now, I would file an extension. If I was married, I'd file separate. I would goose the estimated payment. Goose is kind of like this thing we used to say growing up in the panhandle, throwing on extra is what that means, I guess. I don't know if that's a common saying elsewhere, but throw on extra on top of what you think you owe just to be safe. Like, you know, if you owe $3,000, maybe pay $3,300 or something, and then you're good. Then you can wait until mid-October to file your final return. But I'm definitely really grateful for our tax team this season. They did a great job, I think. First tax season is always the toughest, and second tax season, I'm excited with all the improvements that they've done. And then, you know, third tax season, I think, is going to be even better. I was really scared with us starting a tax business, just to be transparent, because taxes are very difficult as a business in general. But I'm glad we did it, because now we're seeing just mass chaos, and we're seeing, you know, the importance of when you file your taxes and whether or not you file an extension. It's like more important than ever. And the married filing separate or joint stuff is now more important than ever, because, you know, with the save plan, your consequences are you'd pay too much. With IBR and pay, like, now you don't even qualify for a partial financial hardship if you file the wrong way. So like, we're going to have people that DIY'd their taxes, that filed joint, and then like that are on the save forbearance, and then save forbearance gets overturned. They have to recertify immediately for IBR. They find out they don't have a partial financial hardship. They thought they were going to get PSLF. Now they're not even eligible to get, you know, a payment that counts. Now the reality is if you just do a forbearance for a year and file your taxes separate the next year, you might get a partial financial hardship. But a lot of those people are going to panic, make a bad decision, refinance, and lose all PSLF completely. And we're talking like 5-6-figure mistakes here. So those are the kind of things that sort of keep me up at night, knowing the people that listen to this podcast are going to be in great shape. The people who don't and who don't pay attention to this stuff potentially are going to be not in nearly as good shape, and potentially in very bad shape if they make a lot of the mistakes that I expect people will make when they ultimately make a court ruling and all these dominoes start falling. I'm probably talking too much, but let's do another question.
Hello, I am on the pay plan, and I needed to recertify my income in April. So I saw when all of this shutdown happened of the recertification applications, I sent one in through my servicer, through their online portal, and now it's not there anymore, so it clearly wasn't processed, but I'm now in a forbearance, and I wonder if that's why. But I can see also my date was extended now to, I think, October. So I'm wondering if that's why I was put in this forbearance, or if other people are seeing the forbearance, and if I can get out of it, because I'd rather not be in forbearance because I'm working towards public service loan forgiveness. Thank you.
This is one of those situations where you probably don't have any control over things. You can certainly ask your servicer to not leave you in a forbearance. It is possible that they will apply a processing forbearance during these months while they're waiting on recalculating your plan. I think that what we have to do is just sort of see, you know, is this IDR payment count tracker on the studentaid.gov website going to be maintained? So for example, you could go in every month and look at that and see for your forbearance that you have, is it showing as counting or not? And if it's showing as counting, you're probably in a processing forbearance if you don't have any payments coming out. So that's one of those situations where I think short term, you don't want to do anything. You want to wait, probably give it a month until your next payment was supposed to come out in April, and then give it maybe a few more days after that, and then go into studentaid.gov, log on, see if they show any qualifying payment or not in your studentaid.gov portal. So let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Mishiko, and I have a lot of debt racked up from being in school for a long time. I graduated out of my final program with a master's degree in 2020. Then COVID happened, and honestly really have had a pause on my payments since then because I was put on the repay plan. So I wasn't having, my payments were like nothing. They were $0 a month. I guess now I got a notification on Friday that I owed $1,700 a month for my payments. And I tried to like recertify my income-driven repayment plan. And obviously like it's halted right now because of all the decision, the recent decisions that Trump has made. So I guess my question to you is like, do you have any advice on what I should do moving forward? Because there's literally no way that I can afford $1,700 a month, but I also like don't want to not pay it because I don't want to go into default and have it affect my credit. I am going to call my loan service provider tomorrow and see if they are willing to help out in any kind of way. I'm just single family income and I don't have any kids, but I mean, I literally have to pay for everything on my own. So it's just $1,700 going straight to loans is just not feasible for me. I really appreciate your show. I've had major anxiety this weekend and this coming week just because of all of this stuff. And so to have stumbled upon your YouTube has just really helped. Thanks so much.
I know what it's like to have really bad anxiety, and I'm sorry that you're experiencing that. This is one of those situations where you should not have anxiety, because what's going to happen is if you don't have auto pay turned on, they're not going to debit $1,700 from your account. It takes 90 days for a late payment to happen before they report you to the credit bureaus. So if today is like April, then you're talking May, well, all of April, right? One, May to June 3. So essentially you're saying 3 months from now. So I guess you would count it to May to June to July. So probably like early July is the point where you would get like in trouble or something if you had to pay $1,700 and you weren't. So in terms of the save plan forbearance, they're supposed to be updating that to where you're not going to have to make a payment. You can call and ask for a forbearance. And they know that they're screwing everything up right now. I would be shocked if they like wreck your credit because you didn't do anything, because you literally can't do anything right now. So this is one of those situations where deep breath, call and ask for forbearance if you feel the need to do something. But it's also totally okay to do nothing. Go into your service portal, make sure all your contact info is correct, make sure you've not enabled auto pay, and then no money is going to come out of your bank account and they will not debit anything without your permission that way. That's the best solution I have for not worrying. So let's listen to the question.
Hi, my name's Turner. I have a question about my federal student loans. I started school back in 2012 and attended 4 years of art school, and I got about $40,000 to $45,000 in student loan debt, federal student loan debt. After graduation, I started working and made a few payments, maybe three or four, before realizing that my original career wasn't sustainable for me. I decided to go back to school for nursing. I quit my job. And then when I went back to school for nursing, it put my federal loans into deferment. And then right after I graduated from nursing school, I was about to enter repayment again, the pandemic hit and federal payments were paused for like several years. When repayments were set to like resume, I applied for the save plan before the state-led injunction that happened. So my loans have currently been in the save forbearance for a long period of time. I haven't made any of my payments on any of my federal loans since those initial four back in 2016. Here's where I'm stuck. I've been working as a nurse since 2020, and both the hospitals that I've worked for qualify for public student loan forgiveness. My current employer does too. My plan was to wait and to see what happens with safe forbearance before making any decisions, but I'm wondering if that's the right move. Should I sit tight and wait for policy changes, or should I proactively start making payments that start counting towards PSLF? I'd love to hear your advice on this. Thanks for your time, and I appreciate everything you do on the podcast.
Start making payments as soon as you're able to. So studentaid.gov/IDR, set a calendar reminder on your phone every month to go check that website. Currently, it's grayed out, and you can't apply for IBR, income-based repayment. And then at some point, when they ungray out that button again, you would want to go apply and change your repayment plan. And you're also going to want to keep track of this period that the save forbearance happened, because you're going to want to apply for PSLF when you have 120 months of qualifying employment and not qualifying repayment. 120 months of qualifying employment that you certify at studentaid.gov/PSLF gives you the opportunity to apply and buy back any months that were in forbearance in the past. And so that's how you're going to be able to apply as soon as you have the 120 months of qualifying employment. That's when you throw your hat in the ring to try to get PSLF at that point. So you can't change out of the state forbearance even if you wanted to right now, so there's no point in stressing about it. So go ahead and switch into it with a monthly calendar reminder on your phone to go check that website, studentaid.gov/IDR. When it's not grayed out anymore, that's when it's time to switch. Let's take another question.
Hello, my specific question and scenario is that I have $60,000 in student loan, about $30,000 in subsidized and $30,000 in unsubsidized. I make roughly $70,000 a year, but I've come into around $35,000 in a small lump sum of money. And I'm just curious, what's the best way to use that lump sum? Is it to continue to make payments on my loan, or is it to pay down one of those loans? If it's to pay down one of my loans, should I pay down my subsidized or unsubsidized loan first? Or, given the amount I make a year, roughly $70,000, is there a better approach? Thanks for your help.
I'm a fan of knowing what your spending is and calculating what your emergency fund should be, and then making sure that your retirement contributions are topped off and you're doing a good job towards contributing to retirement. For somebody with a 70K income, probably 10% into retirement, like a 401k plan, is probably pretty solid. I would probably set up a brokerage account somewhere. You could go with Vanguard if you're wanting to be DIY. If you don't want to be DIY, you could do like a Betterment Wealthfront kind of place. If you want the maximum amount of help, you could hire a financial planner like SLP Wealth, for example, that could do it for you. But I would say like have a brokerage account where you're putting something in, because hopefully you'll be at a point, some point in your life where you'll be maxing your 401k and you want to have developed that habit of investing outside your 401k so that you can use money before age 60 when you can tap retirement funds. And then I would definitely use some of that 30K to make my student loan payments. And I would kind of buy time. Like it also depends on kind of how young you are. You might not like this job too much. Maybe you love it, but maybe you don't. Maybe you're indifferent to it. One of the best things I ever did for myself was take a break from working and travel the world to figure out what I wanted to do in my life. I knew it wasn't waking up at 5:30 in the morning to go be a bond trader, because at most I was going to make, you know, 10 basis points of outperformance because of how careful risk management was in the bond funds. And these are folks that, while that's a very valid thing to do for somebody, these were folks that were generally already set in life, and so I didn't feel like I was making a huge difference. I think that it's really helpful to have some options around that and say, okay, $30,000, let's say that you wanted to do something similar. Go try to start a business. Go try to travel the world. Go try to start a side hustle or something like that. Have a family memory that you create together. I mean, those things ultimately, for anybody listening to this podcast, you are probably in the top 10 to 20% most financially responsible people in the country. So anybody who's listening to this podcast is pretty much already in a great situation, and they should be willing to take more risk in their life financially because you can afford to. So you could throw it all in the loans. I probably wouldn't. I'd probably take advantage of the money to live life a little bit more inspiringly or excitingly when you're young. That's kind of my thought on that. A few more here, guys.
Travis, I have $610,000 worth of student loans that I have not paid since the pandemic, with zero payments and no interest accrual since the pandemic. But I was enrolled in the SAVE plan, and my loan servicer, that is very difficult to speak with in their customer service, has mentioned that I won't need to recertify for IDR until 2026, and that currently my payments are zero in this time. My question is, if my interest rates are going to be so high as five figures per year almost, even if I recertify when repayments go into effect in 2026, would I want to pay off this student loan as quickly as possible or wait out and make the minimum payments until forgiveness is achieved after a certain while? Thank you.
I mean, certainly keep waiting and take advantage of the zero interest on that large of a loan balance. Like, you might not be getting any credit towards forgiveness, but at least you're not falling backwards in terms of the size of the loan, right? I will say, if you're positive you're going for forgiveness, yes, at some point you want to get off of the SAVE forbearance and apply for a program that counts towards forgiveness. So that's certainly true. If you're having no interest accrual, it means, of course, you're on repay and then SAVE, and that's been your journey through loan repayment. What's going to happen is they're telling everybody that this 2026 recertification date is going to be extended that long, but the reality is it's Probably not going to be, especially for Save Fair Appearance people, because a court ruling is going to happen. They'll say Save's legal. Everybody's got to get off of Save and get on something else, right? So unless you want to pay the standard plan, which for 600K of loans is $6,000 a month, then you're going to have to apply for something else. And when you go apply for something else, it triggers a recertification. And I'm almost sure that the Trump administration will not stop people from having to use their most recent tax return to recertify. Why? Because people have been recertifying with their income when they switch plans ever since the beginning of the pandemic. So presumably the same thing would happen. And then suddenly everybody's, you know, IDR or most recent tax returns are suddenly all relevant. And based on our survey data, 3 in 5 people right now are on the Save Plan forbearance. That's a 60% majority that's on the Save Plan forbearance. So for most people listening, you're going to be forced to recertify, I expect, at any time in 2025 with very little notice. And I don't want to cause anxiety by saying that, but I think it's true. So I think that you just need to be ready for anything. And that's why I suggested earlier in today's pod, you know, filing extensions is not a terrible thing because it just gives you a lot of flexibility ultimately. So let's listen to a few more questions.
Thanks for taking my question. I was previously on the repay and was administratively transferred to the Save plan. I currently have satisfied my payment requirements for the 20-year forgiveness from the repay promissory note. I confirmed that with the Department of Education in January. I'm curious to know your thoughts on what do you think is going to happen in that scenario if the Save plan is axed and I have to go to another plan, and I've already met the payment requirements. What happens there? Also, if I have to switch to another plan and I don't meet the hardship requirement, what are your thoughts there? Just really curious as to what you think about that. Thank you again for taking my call.
This is a tough one because I think the answer is they would have to switch you to the IBR plan, which is 25 years. And so you'd have 20 years of credit with 5 years left to go on IBR. And the question would be, do you have a partial financial hardship or not? And so if it's 20 years, this person probably only has undergrad debt. And undergrad debt often can only be, you know, $30,000, $40,000. And even if there's been a lot of forbearances and growth of the interest, this person probably only owes $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 if the loan has been in like a long-term forbearance kind of thing, accumulating interest. So the balance compared to, you know, the prior caller that had $600,000, the balance is going to be a lot lower on this person's loan. And so it's entirely believable this person might not have a partial financial hardship, because remember that that means your IBR payment is just lower than your standard 10-year payment. So if this person doesn't have that, then you have a couple choices, right? You could say, well, is ICR still a thing? Can I get onto that plan? And would that payment count? Because that's a plan that you can get on without a partial financial hardship. Does that plan not exist anymore? If so, is there any other plans that are out there? Is IBR an option? And if it's not, then there might not be any other option but to continue making payments. And let me tell you what I would do, kind of pointing back to one of the earlier questions in today's show. I would roll the dice if this balance is over 50K. I would roll the dice and see if there's going to be a Democratic administration again in the next point in 5 to 10 years. Because what you could do is you could consolidate the loan potentially, get it onto a 30-year standard plan where you're paying roughly 0.4% of the total balance every month, which is probably reasonably affordable. So if it's, you know, a 60K balance, 0.4% of that balance is like $240 a month. So $240 a month might be kind of affordable compared to like the standard plan, which is $600. And so you could keep that $240 a month payment going for the duration of the Trump administration if they're not letting you get any access to things like IBR or ICR. And then at the end of that 25-year period, the 4-year period at the end of the Trump administration, you could see who wins the election and realize, oh, if it's a Democrat, it's probably going to be some movement to recreate the repay plan or create a more affordable repayment plan, and you might be able to switch on to that. So I think the critical part is there are some people that when the Save plan is killed off are going to have zero chance to get loan forgiveness for the future. Those are people that have incomes much larger than their debts. They're in the private sector. Their most recent tax return was very, very solid, and they had high incomes relative to those debts. Those folks are not getting forgiveness. Even if there's a Democratic administration, I feel pretty confident that those folks should be refinancing once the Save, you know, forbearance is tossed and the 0% interest subsidy ends. Everybody else, it's a little bit more up in the air. So for example, if you have more debt than your income, I would keep them federal, the loans, just in case, just to see what happens over the next few years. It's a free option, right? Not completely free, but fairly low cost. You know, the difference between a 6% loan that's federal and a 5% loan that's private, is not huge, you know, unless you're talking about $400,000 of loans. But even then, it's $4,000 a year. You could think of that $4,000 a year interest difference as insurance if you want to keep your options open with the federal government. It just depends on the individual. So this is going to be a very chaotic period. It's going to be a very confusing period. But people that know the rules, like you listening to this, compared to a lot of other people, are going to save way more money than other people will. It's just reality. It's just how complicated programs work. People that know the rules and pay attention save a lot of money. People that don't get as much. What a podcast episode. We covered a lot. If you want to ask questions like these listeners, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. That's the URL to visit on your phone. Press the record button on your phone. We'll feature the best questions in a pod episode. And took a lot to get through all those questions. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Stay strong, stay positive. And I'm going to end today's podcast with a joke. It's April Fool's when I'm recording this episode. Okay, so it's not serious, but I think we could use some levity and some laughter, right? And in this kind of stressful time. My April Fool's joke is I'm going to tell you what new forgiveness program I think President Trump's going to propose. I think he's going to work with the new Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, to create a partnership with the WWE where you have a cage match of 10 student loan borrowers, and the 10 student loan borrowers compete, and the last one standing gets their loans forgiven. So that is my prediction for my April Fool's Day prediction of what the Trump administration is going to do for student loan forgiveness. If you want more jokes, hopefully I can send out an email with some jokes that'll hopefully make most people laugh and not angry at me. But the goal here is to entertain and inform, because we need really both. We need to laugh more, even in stressful times, right? So thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, hopefully one day you're listening to true crime and you don't have to listen to me anymore. I wouldn't mind that at all. And one day you will be. So if you need any help, go to studentloanplanner.com/book if you need a consult. And you can go to slpwealth.com if you need more holistic, you know, financial planning and such. Thank you all for listening. We do it because of you. That's why we make this show, and really appreciate all the great questions today. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.